All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never-departing shadow. He abused me, he attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those carrying on like this, hatred does not end. She abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those not carrying on like this, hatred ends. Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. Those are the opening stanzas of the Dhammapada, one of the oldest Buddhist texts. And I was recalling to some people in the study group, I think, the last time I was there, that I remembered exactly where I was when I read those stanzas. You remember exactly where you were when, you know, some significant earth-shaking event happens in the news, an assassination or a... Larry, could you move just a little bit? Because there was a person that I could see before that I can no longer see. Just in the middle. Oh, no, you did perfect. Then I can see everybody. Yeah, you don't have to move away, just slightly.
You just need to take off
your hat. Yeah, thank you. So like you remember, a kind of earth-shaking event. And so when I read those lines, for me, it was an earth-shaking event. It was one of those truths that I read and that I had never encountered before. This was quite a long time ago, many, many years ago. And it shook me. It shook me to read particularly the line that he abused me, he defeated me, he robbed me, he took advantage of me. For a person like that, hatred does not end. Why did it shake me? Because I realized that I had that kind of thinking, that I had a pattern of that kind of thinking, of a kind of a pattern of being a resentful person, or being a person who thought of himself as a victim and was always on the lookout for somebody who would come along, and there was a great suspicion that there was somebody that was going to come along and take advantage of me. So it very much shook me when I read those lines, realizing that I had that kind of thinking, that there was a pattern of that kind of thinking going on, and apparently had been for a long time. It was a deeply ingrained pattern. But of course, it helped me a lot to read those lines. It helped me a great deal, because seeing a pattern of your thinking, seeing the way that you make your stories up, is a very valuable experience. So I was thinking now, going back and looking at those lines again in preparation for this talk, since I thought of that experience this not too long ago, I thought the Buddha isn't talking about, like, there's two classes of people. There's, because he says, you know, there's people who think like this, and then there's people who don't think like that, right? It's, that's what it says. For people who think like that, hatred never ends. For people who don't think like that, hatred ends. But it's not like there's the haters over here and there's the non-haters over here. I don't go with that. I think what is being said there is that we're all capable of both those thought processes. We're all capable of hatred, and we're all capable of non-hatred. We're all capable of resentment, and we're all capable of non-resentment. And so this is the beginning of the Buddha pointing out the path of practice for those who would like to become capable of non-hatred, non-victimhood, who would like to develop a generous spirit, a spirit of non-resentment, a spirit of letting be, a spirit of non-hatred. So we have a Zen group here, and in this Zen group we say there is an excellent method. There is an excellent method to setting out on the path of developing awareness of both hatred and non-hatred, and developing awareness of our, what we call, karmic tendencies, our tendencies to think in certain patterned ways based on causes and conditions that arose in our life in the past and through our past action and our past thinking. Based on our past action and our past thinking, we are currently thinking in certain ways. And as we've been told many times in this group, this practice of sitting meditation with our hands just so, and our eyes cast down and our body upright, is an excellent method for casting light on these patterns of thinking and action. And when things are revealed in that light, transformation, change is possible. Change that will lead to happiness. As the Buddha says, so this talk that I'm giving tonight is somewhat, I'm thinking, a follow-up to a talk that I gave that a few people heard, which was at our one-day sitting at the beginning of this month. And that talk, I advertised that talk as aligning with Buddha's wisdom. And some of you came to that, hear that, and came to sit all day on with that topic. And I suggested then, as I'm suggesting now, that sitting meditation practice is an excellent method for aligning with Buddha's wisdom. Aligning with a practice of non-resentment, non-violence, non-harming, and practice of giving and living an upright life. I suggested at that retreat that Buddha's wisdom was like flying at a very high altitude and looking down and seeing the patterns of fields and so forth down below. And so this goes along with this idea that from this perspective of stillness and silence in meditation, we can look down. One of the translations of the Heart Sutra, we don't translate it quite this way, but one of the translations of the opening line is Avalokiteshvara looked down from on high and saw that all five skandhas, heaps, aggregates of human personality were empty. So there is this idea kind of that floats around a little bit in the in the teaching that it's possible to that Buddhist wisdom is like a big perspective on things, like an overview of the patterns of our life, the patterns of our karma. And we can look down from that perspective and heal ourselves and then act in ways that can heal the world. So this topic of aligning with Buddha's wisdom actually came to me some time ago, a few months ago, when I was in Japan. Karen and I were in Japan traveling and on a tour. And in part of that tour, we spent 3 days at a very famous temple complex called Mount Koya or Koya-san. And this is maybe one of the biggest Shingon Buddhist temple complexes in the world. I mean, like, bar none. I mean, it's a huge, huge place. There's something like 170 Shingon temples on this mountain, which is like, it is high up on a mountain, but it's like in a valley high up on a mountain. And it's quite an impressive place. And at that place, we stayed in a Shingon monastery in their guest rooms. And we were invited to witness various ceremonies, and particularly the ceremony that's known as the fire ceremony. And this is a very it's a ceremony like you may have like know ceremonies that, for instance, that involve turning a Buddha wheel or something like that. Or you may have heard of ceremonies that involve chanting Buddha's name over and over again. And so I think the fire ceremony of Shingon Buddhism falls in this category, because those kinds, and we actually have part of our ceremony is like that too, particularly when we dedicate our chants. When the Kokyo reads a dedication of our chants, we're actually, in some of them, it's pretty clear that we're trying to send out blessings beyond this room. We're trying to send out blessings into the world. And I think the fire ceremony and some other ceremonies in Buddhism are a lot like that too. They're trying to send out blessings. The intent of them is to send out blessings into the world. And this is quite an impressive ceremony. It's done by a priest, of course. and he's building a fire in a small wooden building in Japan, which of course has had a great history of fires and burning down their monasteries over and over again. Maybe they've got that kind of under control at this point, but it's nevertheless quite impressive to see this little bonfire get started in the building and grow from just a little height like so to flames that are reaching up nearly to this ceiling here. I mean, maybe not quite that high, but pretty high. And so it's done. The priest starts with a few sticks, and he puts one stick, and when the whole thing is accompanied by chanting that he's doing, and bells that are being rung, and also hand gestures. There's very specific mudras with which the priest picks up the stick, and it was obviously a very specific trained hand gestures with which the stick was offered to the fire and then placed over and over again, you know. And I'm just sort of mimicking it because I obviously haven't been trained in that tradition. It's quite impressive, and I didn't really know what I was seeing exactly. I didn't really have a sense of what is going on here. So when I came home, I did a little research, and it was enlightening to do the research about what the meaning of the fire ceremony, what the point of it is. Shingon Buddhism is a school of esoteric Buddhism, so it draws inspiration from a form of Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana Buddhism that was imported to China, and then Kukai, who was the founder of Shingon, went to China and learned this form of esoteric Buddhism and brought it back to Japan and made it his own. And he was quite of an autodidact. He was just apparently just a brilliant person. Of many talents. He was a sculptor, a painter, and a religious, founder of a whole school of religion in Japan. So what I learned was that the basic premise of Shingon Buddhism is called Sokushin Jobutsu, which means attaining Buddhahood in this very life. And as I understand, what the priest is doing in the fire ceremony is actually, I mean, the priest is in front of your eyes becoming Buddha through his engagement with what are called the three mysteries in Shingon. And the three mysteries they won't be news to you. The three mysteries of Shingon Buddhism are the mysteries of body, the mysteries of speech, and the mysteries of mind. Body, speech, and mind. In, our regular and our normal understanding of the activities of body, speech, and mind, these are the places where this is where we do karma. Body, speech, and mind is where we do karma, right? Where we create karma, where we act out karma. In the Shingon tradition, what's happening is that these three the body, speech, and mind through ritual gestures. Mudra, through true words, which is the meaning of Shingon, Shingon means true words. So through the chanting that's being done and through the priest's total immersion in the ceremony, there are no women Shingon priests yet. Sure it will happen, but it's a barrier. There's a glass ceiling there that hasn't been broken, as far as I know. But anyway, through the priest's engagement with body, speech, and mind in this way, the actions of body, speech, and mind are transformed into they are the three mysteries, and the priest, according to their understanding, the priest in the application of these practices is becoming Buddha. But he's not becoming Buddha for his own sake. He's becoming Buddha for the sake of the people that he's doing the ceremony for. And he's always doing the ceremony for somebody. He's always giving away the ceremony. If he wasn't giving away the ceremony, it wouldn't be Buddhism. He wouldn't be doing it for gain. So I was very impressed, and I thought I was strongly impressed by the priests that we met and by how humble they really were, and especially we stayed at a monastery where the head priest was there, and he met with us, and we had a translated session with him, and I was really taken with the man, and I thought that he was really a person of true faith, true religion, and so if he thinks he's becoming Buddha while doing this ceremony, well, I guess I feel like, great. That's wonderful. Go ahead and do that. It's a little not what we think we're doing, but when we're practicing. But continuing research on the subject, I did read a critic of modern Shingon Buddhism, who felt like the practice has been corrupted by money, I guess, and by the expectations that sort of have arisen around the temple, that donors give large sums of money, and there's apparently some kind of quid pro quo for certain people doing the ceremony for them. There's kind of a quid pro quo expectation of donation, right? Then that's common in Buddhism, right? That we do a ceremony for you and you give a donation. In the cemetery, this amazing cemetery at Mount Koya, which is like nothing you could ever imagine. It's so huge and amazing and has so many monuments in it. And it's 800 years old or something, or long or older. But there are monuments and memorials that are, I did remember after I read this criticism, there are monuments and memorials that are like dedicated to Panasonic Corporation and Mitsubishi and so forth. So I wondered if the critic might have some true point about, yeah, some basis for thinking that there has been some tainting, you know, going on somewhere along the way. But I think still there's, you know, it's still Buddhism, and I think there's still something pure and uncorrupted about the fire ceremony, and it's something that when we're, you know, we can consider that when we're sitting zazen, we are doing the fire ceremony, and we are doing the fire ceremony in the sense that we are doing it, you know, for ourselves, because we don't exclude ourselves from, you know, the blessings that this particular version of the fire ceremony, seated on a cushion with you know, flames that go up like this. We're like that, right? So we're like a fire a little bit. So we don't exclude ourselves from the blessings that come from this practice, but we also are doing this to send out blessings, to be one of my teachers you know, used to say, when you're practicing, you're a receiving and a sending station for the Dharma. A receiver and a sending station, like a transmitter. You're like a transmitter. You're receiving a signal and you're sending out a signal. And that's what I feel like there's correspondence for us with this fire ceremony. Receiving a signal, sending out a signal. And there's also another correspondence, which is, it's often talked about that this practice, sitting still and seeing what the patterns that come up, whatever they, you know, to see your craziness, your neurosis, and to see that continually come up and be reviewed and be observed in the calm light of sitting meditation as many times as it continues to come and continues to come. It's like every time it comes, it's like another stick on the fire, and you're burning up that karma. You're burning up that karma. Each time you see the pattern, especially if you can see the pattern and not judge it, not make a comment on it, not have more pattern come up. In other words, just see the pattern come, see the thinking come, see the feelings come. And each time you see that, without getting involved, without messing with it, without fooling around at all, just seeing it come, it's like another stick on the fire of blessings going out to the world. It's hard to see how this is true, but it is true. It is. Maybe it's not even hard to see. I don't think it's hard to see at all, but you know, we work in our practice with the mystery of body, speech, and mind. And the reason it's a mystery is that it's not fixed. It's not body, speech, and mind aren't a fixed, solid, permanent thing. And that's the reason why, you know, body, speech, and mind are a mystery. They can change. Your body, your speech, your mind is transforming all the time, and you have some influence over that transformation. And that's what the Buddha is saying. You know, if you foster, or if you let mind foster thoughts of being abused or being mistreated, or he did this to me, or she did that to me, she said, if you let that go on, you're not really taking control. You have more control than that. So when you see those thoughts coming, don't give them any energy. Just don't give it any energy. It's like we're healed by what we're not doing. We're healed by what we're not doing, what we're not giving energy to. It's often the case. The fourth bodhisattva vow is Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. That's our translation that we use. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Another translation that other centers use is Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. I vow to be in accord with it. Something like that. So, you know, in our practice, we don't think, we think that what we're doing is becoming aligned with the Buddha way. You know, we're becoming in accord with the Buddha way. We're not, in our practice, we don't think, I'm becoming Buddha. So it's a little different from Shingon. We don't have this idea. Well, actually, there is an idea in the Mahayana that the end of the bodhisattva path is Buddhahood. But that's a long way off. But I think the main thing is I don't think we have to worry about becoming Buddha, but I also think it's very important that we not think that we are simply sentient beings. You know, that we are simply we shouldn't be stuck in a view of ourselves as sentient beings, and of course, I would propose we shouldn't be stuck in a view of ourselves as Buddha either. But it not being stuck in any view of ourself, and it's particularly, you know, an unwholesome views of ourself and unwholesome views of others, that's the Buddha way. I failed to bring a watch.
8:35.
Oh, perfect. So if you would like to make some questions or comments, or I think I've made my point that I set out here, I came here to make tonight.
I would like to thank you for the opening lines of your talk, Jim.
Thank the Buddha for those.
Well, I do, because when I first discovered Buddhism, I went to the bookstore and I bought a pocket edition of the Dhammapada because it was the cheapest book I could find on the subject. And mine was a little bit different translation. It went something like, we are what we think. The world arises from our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. And it captured me right there. And I have found these words to be true. It's really an astounding thing. And I want to thank you for repeating them tonight.
have three comments. First, in regard to sitting being a kind of goma fire ceremony, I recall a chant which I don't hear much, which I never hear. It goes something like, and I'm going to murder this, forgive me, but it's worth it anyway. Only within burns this fire that I kindle, my heart the altar.
Sometimes I think about that.
The other comment is that, or it's really a question, you mentioned there are no Shingon priests in Japan. There are Shingon priests in America. Women Shingon priests.
Oh, women.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I forgot that part.
Yeah, part the women part.
And it occurs to me to wonder, are there female Zen priests in Japan?
There are actually female Zen priests, and we just heard a story from our friend Alexei, who went to Japan. Do you remember that story he told?
I don't.
Okay. Well, Alexei went to Antaiji, which is the home temple of. We've been studying in our study group. We've been studying a book, several books actually, by Okamura, by what's his first name? Shohaku Okamura, who is a American now, a Zen teacher, but born in Japan. And his teacher was Uchiyama Roshi in Japan. And so Alexei, who comes here for one day sittings, told us he went to Antaiji and he stayed for a sesshin. And he told us that temple is about to transition. It's now this is kind of an eclectic temple, and Uchiyama was an eclectic teacher, but that temple was taken over by a German man who is now aging out, and he is going to put up a woman teacher who's going to take over that temple in Japan, and I think a Japanese woman, so, you know, the world is changing everywhere, and there are women Zen teachers. I don't know them all, but they're, and when we were on our tour, we were with Roshi Joan Halifax, and she has given lecture at Eheji and Soji-ji, which are the big main temples of Soto Zen in Japan. She's never like been a resident there, but she has taught there, and so slowly, you know, things are changing.
And finally, I'd like to comment on your observation about non-grasping, not holding on to ideas, and a good illustration or example is Dogen Zenji. Because tonight we, as part of our chant, we were reading some of his writings, and he said, "Have no thoughts about becoming a Buddha." In Zazen.
Right.
But on another occasion, he quoted an other teacher to the effect, as I recall, "Those who in past lives were not enlightened, in this life will be." Will become enlightened. So he has no bone in his tongue at all. He just
There might be a difference between becoming a Buddha and being enlightened.
Right. He said in the chant tonight, "Have no designs on becoming a Buddha."
Right.
I think you referred to this toward the end, but I just wanted to, well, clarify for myself too, I guess, but that it wouldn't be just that, you know, he beat me, he robbed me, he blah blah or she. It would also be generating more karma, unwholesome karma, if you were saying to yourself, I beat somebody, I cheated somebody, I, you know, did this or that or the other thing that was harmful. Right? I mean,
well, you know, it's a funny thing about that, because shame and blame are considered wholesome dharmas in Buddhism. And so the reason is, and then we have like expressions like eat the blame. So to actually think that you caused some harm, I mean, you know, to dwell on it or, you know, to beat yourself up constantly about it. Yes, I agree with you. That would be unwholesome. But to acknowledge it and confess it and repent of it, I think that's actually wholesome.
Well, I was thinking of the repetition.
The repetition of beating, you know, yourself up. Yeah.
Because those thoughts then, if you're dwelling on those thoughts, you're not being present to what's going on right now, seems to me.
It's true. There's things that...
And if it's a habit.
Yeah. And it may be true that there are things that you have done in your life that you will never get over having wished you hadn't done. Like, for instance, for me, when I was little, my brother and I were playing, you know, as kids do, wildly around a car. And as part of the play, I slammed the door of the car, and his fingers were on the post of the... You know, the old cars, they're not like this anymore, but they used to have a post you could grab onto, right?
It's real metal.
And, you know, I'll never get over that. I'll never get over having caused that pain. I mean, it's still just like you reacted. I can think about that, and it's still just... It still is like a knife in my heart, you know? But, you know, I don't think of it every day or anything, and I don't beat myself up on it. But there are things that you'll carry, you know. There are wounds we carry that is just part of life. And, you know, it's just the way we carry, you know, scars, and, you know, we carry mental, you know, things that we've done too. And it's just part of being a human being, I think, to have that, those kind of experiences with us that we carry. And I think it's just the way it is. Humble thing, you know, that a humbling thing. Galen?
Maybe just one more thing. It was, let's see. Oh, I guess I also wanted to say something about, you know, the phrase, it isn't that you weren't robbed or that you weren't cheated or whatever, if that's what you're saying to yourself, but it's just the story that keeps going on and on and on about it.
Yeah. That's,
you know,
right.
You mentioned the word story, and I wanted to say, well, it did happen, probably, you know, maybe it was true, but it's a story that you keep telling yourself over and over and over again, that's what can be harmful.
It's like when that guy snatched your purse at the light rail station, right?
I haven't thought of that in quite a while, but I did think of it.
He definitely robbed you.
Yeah, he did.
And back at that time, I recall you saying it was my fault.
Actually, I did, yes. Well, partly at least my fault. That's what I thought.
Oh, but the great story about this is she was so creative in her response. She yelled after the kid, "I know your mother."
Is that true?
True. True.
Did you tell his mom?
She didn't know his mother.
Oh.
But I thought it was very creative.
That's really creative. Wow, that's impressive. Might as well say something. This is really helpful because I like the part about in the introduction of the Dhammapada where it says it ends when there's non-hate, because recently there's been this reconnection with somebody from my past who was abusive, and I don't know whether I'm more angry at myself for letting it happen, or I think a little bit of both, but I do feel this sense of I'm not angry anymore at my it's what happened, and it kind of happened again recently, but I feel this level of kind of acceptance towards myself and also towards that this person. And it feels like it's actually finally coming to an end because I'm able to see it really for what it is. But I feel like for where I'm at right now, it's when I talk about it with some people who I trust, it doesn't feel good to talk about it. But in the same way, my heart wants to just forgive and pretend. But some people you have to set boundaries with, you know, and so is it helpful to acknowledge in the same way that you would acknowledge your own letting something happen or your own shame, this practice of shame, shaming ourselves and our actions, acknowledging them, to also say no, this isn't acceptable.
Well, what's coming to me in response to this is that the Buddha is not telling you how to feel. You know, you have the right to feel and respond exactly from how you feel. You know, and if you were, you know, mistreated, you have to. You know, I think what a practice viewpoint is that you really drill down. How do I feel? Not what I should feel or what I, you know, what Buddha told me to do, but how do I feel right now about that? And what do I want to do? You know, maybe based on teaching, but not teaching that overrides, you know, your heart.
Your
heart, you know, just so I think it's really a subject for careful inquiry about how do we think about abusers, you know, how do we interact with them the next time we see them and that sort of thing, and you know it's a matter for careful inquiry and not necessarily formulaic, I think. You know, but really being true to yourself is what's being encouraged. Is because your stance could be, I don't want to have anything to do with you. Please stay far away. Or it could be different. Or it could be, I don't want anything like what happened before. But when I see you on the street, I will acknowledge your presence and I will wish, you know, for your welfare. But whatever it is, it has to be what you, you know, where, you know, not a formulaic, but where your heart is, and be true to that. And you may not even know. It takes some really inquiry and really staying close to your own feeling. Linda.
I listened to, I think it was This American Life, or one, you know, an NPR program that was an hour long about a certain kind of therapy for people who have been through especially sexual trauma, but trauma. And it occurred to me as I was listening to this therapy, it's a 10-week series. It's called PCT therapy, and I can't remember what the letters stand for. But what they do in this specific therapy is deconstruct your story over the trauma, basically. You know, you write down the stories, like, it may have been my fault. I still think it might be because I was wearing, you know, shorts, or and all the stories that you tell, and then you actually deconstruct the whole story of the event, and it's kind of like you were talking about when you look at things, you burn off that karma. Well, in this therapy, they've shown quite a bit of success in. You look at your story, and you burn off the PTSD. You burn off the energy that your story has on your body. And it was really fascinating. If you know anyone that's living with PTSD or trauma, check out this therapy, because it seems to be really, really successful. And your question is what kind of brought up that idea, or made me think of that therapy.
I think I've heard of that therapy, but I think you might have the letters wrong.
Cognitive processing therapy. I heard that talk is
CPT.
Yeah.
That's not what I said. I said PCT.
Yeah, CPT. That sounds something. Yeah.
Cognitive processing therapy.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, once you go through the series, you're done. It's not like, and it's not in place of talk therapy or whatever, but it's just a process.
It is probably talking about
8:52.
Okay. It's time to go. Thank you very much.